Let us pray. May the words that I speak and the meditations of our hearts be acceptable to you, O God, our rock and our salvation. Amen. I want to say a special thanks to Pete and to Carol, who were willing to lead services. Pete, you got snowed out, but part of your sermon, I know, ended up in the contact, which was a good thing. But save those thoughts. We'll use that. You'll be back in the pulpit soon. Carol, thank you again, and I want to thank Pastor Wally and also Deacon Margie, and finally Pastor Wilhelm, who I know brought with her not only a wonderful message, but also that love that just exudes from her, that kindness and goodness, and she's such a shepherdess. So I think it really was a special time to have the opportunity to hear from other people and to welcome them back, because I know they have come to love you too. So this Sunday is known as Mardi Gras Sunday in our congregation, but in the larger context of the liturgical traditions of our church, we mark this Sunday as Transfiguration Sunday. Transfiguration is that in-between space between Epiphany, the season of light, which began with the Magi following the star to the infant Jesus in the manger, and the season of Lent, which begins our accompaniment of Jesus' journey to the cross. And of course, we start the season of Lent with Ash Wednesday, this coming Wednesday. But Transfiguration, this text, is really a difficult story to decipher. I mean, we're familiar with it. We're familiar with the names Jesus, you know, Moses, Elijah, and so on. But what does it really mean? Peter, James, and John, his closest disciples, are not really the only ones confused by what's going on in this story. I think you and I, as we read Luke's account today, can only join them in sort of getting lost in the confusing elements of the story. The story begins with Jesus leading the three disciples up to the top of a mountain to pray. And then when Jesus is praying, as Luke tells us, the appearance of Jesus' face changes, and his clothes become dazzling white. As a child, every time I heard this story, I'd think about, you know, laundry detergent commercials. And his clothes became dazzling white. That's not really what we're supposed to think about, though. Suddenly and mysteriously, the ancient lawgiver Moses arrives with that great Hebrew prophet of old, Elijah. And then Elijah and Moses and Jesus are having this conversation, witnessed by these bewildered disciples. And they're talking about Jesus' impending departure. And of course, Jesus has tried to prepare his disciples for his departure and where he is going and what's going to happen in Jerusalem, but they're always clueless. And they wonder, maybe, are we having a dream? Because after all, Luke mentions that Peter and his companions were weighed down with sleep. Had Peter and James and John all died and gone to heaven, they must have wondered what in the world was happening to them on this mountain. Time and space, as they knew it, stood still. It sort of makes me think of the opening lyrics from the rock group Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody. How many of you have seen the movie? Yeah? Oh, not very many, but anyway. Is this real life, it starts? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes, look up to the skies, and see. Well, Peter, of course, he can never keep quiet. I love Peter. He's so flawed. He's so human. He can't keep his mouth shut. I have that problem. You know, he talks because he gets nervous or he thinks he has to fill the space. He can never restrain himself under pressure. And so without thinking very clearly, he just begins to babble about the first emotion that he's feeling, which is that he wants this magic moment to last forever. He knows he's been drawn into something unusual, something special. And so he says to Jesus, "Master, it is good for us to be here. Let us make three dwellings," or in some translations it says three booths, "one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah." And actually, when Peter suggests that they build these three booths or dwelling place, one for each for Jesus and for Elijah and for Moses, his mind is speeding. He's making connections with the ancient stories that have been passed on down through the generations of the Israelites. In fact, as Peter's trying to desperately process what is happening to try to fit it within time and space as he knows it, into some kind of familiar framework that he can grasp. What he lands on, actually, may be a memory of the ancient Jewish tradition associated with the Day of the Lord. This was to have been a time when God would draw history to its climax, defeat Israel's enemies, and celebrate with what was termed the Feast of Booths. So maybe Peter, as he's speeding ahead on his opioids or whatever, you know, maybe he was thinking, well, this is it. This is the Feast of Booths. This is that moment. And we're here. So let's build some booths. Let's get on with this. Maybe this psychedelic mountaintop experience is actually that moment. That moment that the whole of Israel had been waiting for. So while Peter is busy talking, suddenly he notices a dramatic change in the environment. A cloud comes over and overshadows them, and that stops Peter short. And he and the others become terrified. And the cloud envelops them. And then, from the cloud, came a voice that said, "This is my son, my chosen. Listen to him." Look at the top of your bulletin. Look at the front of your bulletin. "Listen to him." He's highlighted. And for us, now we're 2,000 years removed in some, the truth slowly dawns that we're experiencing deja vu. Because the voice coming out of the cloud, the words that are spoken, come straight from Jesus' baptism at the River Jordan, don't they? But Peter, James, and John would not have had the same response as we do because they weren't present at Jesus' baptism. He hadn't called them yet. They were still casting their nets by the Sea of Galilee in their old lives when Jesus went to his cousin John at the River Jordan and asked him to baptize him. Oh, so it's confusing. What's going on here? What's the link that Luke is trying to communicate to the community of his day and to readers that would follow, like us, 2,000 years afterwards? Well, I think we need to begin by focusing more carefully on what the voice coming out of the cloud is saying. "This is my son, the beloved. Listen to him." Just as suddenly, the voice is heard, it's all gone. The otherworldly, dazzling white appearance of their rabbi and friend Jesus, gone. Moses, the lawgiver, gone. Elijah, the great prophetic voice from their ancestral past, gone. So what was this mountaintop experience really all about? Oh, biblical scholars have had a ball with this. They'd love to debate what this was all about. It's almost as though, if you read the different scholars, it's like everyone's picking up a kaleidoscope. And they twist it one way, and they get one answer, and they twist it another way, and they get another answer, and on and on and on. So from one angle, some argue this is about Jesus replacing Moses and Elijah. When they disappear and only Jesus remains, it's clearly a sign that Jesus is replacing the great ancestral religious figures of Moses and Elijah. But then, if you turn the kaleidoscope another direction, the scholars suggest that the transfiguration was really all about Moses and Elijah confirming that Jesus is on the right path. So Jesus isn't replacing them. He has incarnated the mission of Moses and Elijah, the first of the prophets. But if you rotate the kaleidoscope yet another turn, and the Transfiguration story becomes yet something else in the eyes of scholars. It becomes about Jesus teaching his disciples what it means to follow him. One scholar says to me, this dazzling white image on the mountaintop symbolizes the big picture vision of God's work in the world. God's vision is glory. It's liberation. It's abundance. It's well-being for all. And so as Jesus' disciples, this scholar suggests, today, as Jesus' disciples today, as you and I are his disciples today, we need to be reminded of the big picture. And that's what this story is all about. We need a glimpse of the vision of the big picture to know what we're working toward in our daily lives of discipleship. I don't know about you, but none of this works for me. To be honest with you, none of it works. You know, I could take the kaleidoscope and move it all day long and get different answers from the scholars, and it still wouldn't affect me much. Certainly, it doesn't satisfy me. I like better what my friend David Lowe says. I like that he admits to the confusing nature of the Transfiguration story, and I like that he advises focusing instead on the dramatic movement of the story. So forget the words. Forget these weird people that appear all together in time and space on the mountaintop. Lowe's cuts through all the bewilderment of that and guides us to look carefully at what Jesus does. He takes his disciples up the mountain. But then, after a period of revelation and transformation and transfiguration, he leads them back down again. Peter wants to stay, doesn't he? He wants to build some booths and have them live there with all together. Celebrate. Stay on the mountaintop. They all go. Only Jesus remains. And what he does is he takes them back down the mountain. And the next part of Luke's gospel gives us this horrendous picture of the suffering of a boy possessed with demons. And Jesus loses his patience with his disciples and with all the people around him because they've tried to keep him at bay. They haven't really done anything to help this man and his son. But of course, Jesus does. So we're not supposed to stay up on the mountain. We're supposed to follow Jesus down again. Down into the mundane nature of everyday life. Down into the nitty-gritty details of misunderstanding and squabbling and disbelieving disciples. Down into the religious and political quarrels of the day. Down into the jealousies and rivals, both petty and gigantic, that color our relationships. Down into the poverty and the pain that are part and parcel of our life in this world. Jesus came down. Why is this important? That Jesus came down and led his disciples with him down after that transfiguration on the mountaintop. Well, David Lowe sums it up again like this. Jesus' downward movement from his rightful place, from his rightful place in glory, to embrace our lot and life out of love is, in a very real sense, the essence of the gospel. This isn't a story about our going up. It's a story about Jesus coming down. All the way down into our brokenness, our fear, our disappointment, our loss, my panic about leaving my cozy little apartment and coming back and facing you all again. All the way to the cross. So that we might live in hope, knowing that wherever we may go, Christ has already been there. And that where Christ is now, we will one day be. The journey up to the mountaintop and then back down again is to show Jesus' dearest disciples and us today that God is for us. In our own lives, we can point to some real mountaintop experiences, can't we? All of us can. If we said, tell me about the highest mountaintop experience of your life so far, you'd maybe have to think for a minute, but you'd come up with something because these are the exceptions to the way our everyday lives unfold, aren't they? The mountaintop experiences. I finally finished, Frida, the biography written by your brother-in-law, Oscar Brandt, and I have it today. I'm going to return it to you. He wrote it for his children and his grandchildren, telling the wrenching story of what he lived through during and after World War II. He began with a privileged, idyllic childhood and early youth to losing literally everything except his life as he became a stateless refugee, eventually beginning all over again in this country. And now in his 90s, the narrative of Oscar's life story begins on a mountaintop, descends deep into the valley of the shadow of death, and then emerges once more to rediscover peace and joy and blessings that he will never take for granted as long as he lives. And speaking of Oscars, this is bad. This is like a pun, a bad pun. I don't know how many of you get caught up in Oscar fever, but since I was, you know, in my confinement, there wasn't a whole lot else to do. So I began to take a great interest in the Oscars this year. And because of demand, so my bill's going to be higher this year, this month, I began to watch some of the leading contenders. And one that I found unexpectedly moving was Bohemian Rhapsody, the story of Freddie Mercury and the rock group Queen. Now, some of us are old enough to know that rock group, some of us probably not. And if you haven't seen the movie, you might want to watch it. As I thought about this transfiguration story against the backdrop of that movie and about the arc of Freddie Mercury's life, it made an impact on me. To be sure, he was really a talented guy. And he actually ascends to the mountaintop of the music industry together with his family of choice, which were his fellow band members, the rock group Queen. But once he gets there, he doesn't really feel he needs the group anymore. So he lusts for a solo career, he abandons his mates, and looks in all the wrong places to fill the emptiness that follows his decision to go it alone. And the story has many twists and turns, but in the end, Freddie recognizes that he is nothing without the unconditional love and support and collaborative energy that he experienced together with his bandmates. And he goes back, like the prodigal son, and he begs for forgiveness. And guess what? The miracle is they welcome him back, like the prodigal son. And in the end, they see through him, and they see him through the greatest challenges of his life, which were yet to come. Spoiler alert, I won't tell you about what they were. Which brings us back to Mardi Gras Sunday. We're celebrating with some abandon what it means to grasp that God is for us. We're preparing to accompany Jesus on his Lenten journey to the cross. But before we start on that long journey, the journey when we are called to give things up, like fear, or that we are alone in our troubles, we have a party. That's today. We have a party that anticipates where the Lenten journey is ultimately headed, and this journey does not end at the cross. Everything worth celebrating begins and ends at Easter, when the glory that is hinted at on the Transfiguration mountaintop comes into fullness and makes all the difference in our lives. Voice from that cloud on the mountaintop says to us this morning, listen to him, listen to Jesus. He's showing us what it means that God is for us. Tune in to Jesus, tune out of your fears, have a party, celebrate that God is for us. And church should not be the place we look for order and stability, thank God, around here. David Lowe says, but rather the place we meet up to share our stories of wonder and worry and hope and disappointment and stand with each other as the God of Moses and Elijah and Jesus draws near once again to unsettle our plans and meet us in the mystery of God's love.